We have with us live in the studios once again, Jav Parrish and Maria Tomczyk, both with Eat This Steak. Good morning.
Good morning.
Morning.
All right. Jumping into this week's news, starting out with the Seattle Police Department and developments there.
Yeah, there was more news this week on the shooting of John T. Williams, the Native American woodcarver who was shot in broad daylight on the streets of downtown Seattle in August. It turns out that the Seattle Times posted some information on their website, some photos from the video in the police car, and they posted some of the witness statements on their website. And it turns out that there was only about 4 seconds from when Officer Burke shouted his warnings at Williams and when he actually shot him, which is not very much time, and certainly not the same amount of time that he told the press and the other police officers investigating the shooting at the time.
Yeah, it's actually about one-third as long as that sentence was.
Yeah, and the witness statements, I read through the 3 or 4 witness statements that were posted up on the Seattle Times website, and it was amazing how much they agreed with each other. But they said things like they couldn't hear what Burke was saying, that he was, quote, mouthing something to Williams, and then finally shouted, hey, 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 right before he shot him. All of them agree that Williams was walking away from Burke when he was shot. And a couple of them say he was walking very slowly or shuffling slowly away, so clearly not being aggressive in any way. They all agree that Williams was not aggressive and that he was no threat to Burke and that the shooting was completely unwarranted. So I would urge people to check those out and read those if you have any questions at all about what went on in this incident.
Yeah, and you know, with SPD, I mean, you know, PR 101 is that when you have a scandal or negative publicity about something, it's best to get it all out in the open and immediately rather than having it dribble out in dribs and drabs after week after week after week. And that's exactly what we've had with the Williams shooting. We've had, you know, more evidence coming to light, more evidence coming to light, more evidence coming to light, and we have continued to have SPD not take this particularly seriously. In fact, with the new incident this week, once again, we have the SPD belittling what appears to be a case of egregious use of force.
Yeah, this Wednesday, a local TV station aired a video from a store camera showing an undercover police undercover cop kicking a suspect, a 17-year-old African-American suspect who had raised his hands and was surrendering. The officer, James Lee, kicked him in the, quote, upper thigh area, although it looked like the groin to me. Once the suspect dropped to the floor, Lee went on kicking him, kicked him in the torso, and then kicked him in the face until he was pulled off by a uniformed officer. So that's created a bit of a scandal. The ACLU has said that they are going to send a letter to the U.S. Department of Justice requesting that they investigate the Seattle Police Department over that incident. What I found very interesting is that Police Chief Diaz responded to this by saying, well, oh, you know, we might refer the investigation to an outside law enforcement agency, blah, blah, blah. Exactly the same thing that he said about the Williams shooting, which means he's starting to sound a little bit like a broken record.
Yeah. Meanwhile, we're probably about a week away from the Police Officers Guild giving the cop the, you know, Officer of the Month award.
Yeah. In the meantime, Deputy Chief Clark Kimmerer, who has spoken with the press a lot more than Chief Diaz has, he told the Seattle Times in relation to the video incident of the 17-year-old suspect getting kicked several times by an undercover officer. He said that SPD officers need to be made aware that there are video surveillance cameras everywhere now. And I read that and I just thought, okay, if that's the message that you're giving your officers, that the crime is not assault, it's not excessive use of force, the crime is getting caught on video, that's not a good message.
Yeah, and the of course implicit instructions behind that is go ahead and kick the crap out of suspects, just don't do it in camera range.
Yeah, just look around you first.
All right. Well, moving on to national and a lot of hoopla this week over pat-downs.
Yeah, and a surprise development last night, the TSA announcing just in time for the height of the tourist season that there will be full cavity searches and Passengers will be forced to travel naked in the future. Sorry, that's next week's notes here. We do our notes several weeks in advance here. This week there's been quite a bit of backlash.
I was going to ask, was that the proposed policy that didn't get by? No, there's been a lot of backlash over this new security measures at airports. One of the reasons for the backlash is that the new security at the airports is not the same everywhere. Some airports you go through the full body scanners. Other airports don't have them yet, where it's still just a metal detector. Some airports you can go through the scanner if you've got a Kleenex in your pocket and it sets off. And they see something in your pocket, they can pull you aside and also do an extremely invasive and embarrassing pat down.
Yeah, which is known in the technical security trade as feeling them up.
Yes, and the pat downs in particular are evoking an enormous backlash. Two pilots this week said that they are suing the Department of Homeland Security because they believe the new security protocols are a violation of the Fourth Amendment protection against unreasonable search and seizure. And they're saying that the pat downs, the invasiveness of the pat downs, is the sort of frisking that cops do to suspects when they have probable cause. In this case, there is no probable cause. The only activity that you're engaging in is trying to get on an airplane. Therefore, that's a violation of your Fourth Amendment rights. It's interesting, too. It's not just pilots that are suing Homeland Security. Flight attendants have also been protesting. Their unions have been protesting. The ACLU and other civil liberties groups and privacy right groups are also getting in on the act, too.
And a lot of people have been saying they're not going to fly. There's been an enormous customer backlash as well. Disabled people who probably have cause under the ADA as a protected class, because they're going to be pulled over almost every time if they have any kind of prosthetic device or anything that would set off the body scanners.
A wheelchair, you know, you can't take a wheelchair through those imaging devices because they won't be able to see your body completely. So any person traveling in a wheelchair, anyone with, as Job said, with an implant or a medical device, will always have to go through the pat down, and that can be perceived as discrimination against a protective class of people. If you are disabled and you always have to go through the pat downs.
I mean, not to mention the number of people who just find those kind of invasive searches. I mean, what about people who've been the victims of sexual assault? How do they respond to something like that?
Yeah,
it really prevents a lot of people from doing air travel.
Yeah, and parents have been saying, you know, they don't want anybody touching their children that way, so they don't want to be taking their kids on airplane flights anymore. I mean, it's just an incredible problem. So there are a couple of websites now that have formed for people who want to protest the new security measures. One is called wewon'tfly.com. Another one is optoutday.com. Opt-out day is coming up this next Wednesday, the day before Thanksgiving, traditionally the busiest year for airports and the airline industry for
the
whole year. Yeah. And they're suggesting that people, when they reach the security checkpoints, that you decide not to go through the scanner, just opt out and make those lines for the pat down very, very, very long. Swamp them.
Yeah. And there's also lots of creative suggestions about what you can do when you're going through the pat down, which, you know,
they've been making suggestions that men wear kilts, that people who feel comfortable with their bodies strip down to their underwear in order to embarrass others. You can bring your little lab rat companion animal with you and stuff it in your pocket and surprise the person at the pat down. You know, you can eat lots of garlic before you go.
Don't bathe for a week.
Not bathe for a week. You can make interesting moaning sounds every time they touch you, or you can laugh, or you can yell ouch every time they touch you.
Yeah, and, you know, to be fair, I mean, the people who are doing these pat-downs probably don't like it any better than anybody else, at least let's hope not. But, they're not the ones who are making the policy. But unfortunately, this is what passengers are left to try and do. And if there's enough of a backlash, then the airlines themselves are going to start pressing for a change in this policy because they're going to be hurting financially.
Yeah, and one of the things that I always hear as the argument against protesting these kinds of security measures is, well, Maria, you know, you wouldn't want your airplane blown up by a terrorist. And I would like to point out that, you know, life is risky. We make calculations of risk all the time. Whenever you get in the car, whenever you cross the street, whenever you decide, am I going to take the baby on the plane, et cetera, et cetera. You know, you can't make life so completely safe that you're never going to have any kind of a risk. And I tell you, your risk of getting hit by a car crossing the street and getting seriously injured is much, 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 or killed is much, 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 much higher than having a terrorist try to set their underwear on fire on your flight.
Yeah, and a couple other things about that. One is that, the whole threat of terrorists attacking airplanes did not start with 9/11. It's a threat that's been with us for several decades now. It's just in the last decade that we've become essentially a nation of bedwetters, that we become unwilling to live with any risk, no matter how minuscule it might be. And all of these various actions by the TSA, from taking off one's shoes to the banning of toothpaste and gels and liquids on planes to the body scanners to these latest pat downs, these are all reactions to the previous attack. These are all, you know, fighting the last war, basically. You know, that's not where the next threat is going to come from. It really is basically theater and security theater, having nothing to do with the actual protection of airlines from this threat. It really is inconveniencing and far worse than that for millions and millions and millions of people for the sake of political theater.
Yeah, and like you pointed out to me on the phone last night, Jav, when we were talking about this issue, that airplanes are no longer the prime target anymore. A better target for any kind of a terrorist would be the long, very, very long lines leading up to airport security, because, of course, you don't have to go through security first to set off a bomb in the line for security.
Yes, and, you know, opt-out day would be a fine day for that.
Yes. Well, but, and you told me last night, too, remember, Maria, that's what they're doing in Iraq right now. Where, you know, many of the suicide bombers are attacking checkpoints, driving up to them, waiting in line until there's a lot of people around them and setting off the bomb.
Yeah.
All right. And related to this, if you don't opt for the pat down, then you've got the full body scanners and there's news
very invasive
tangential to that.
Full body scanners. One of the things I notice whenever they show you what the image is going to look like for the full body scanner, it's always some guy standing there with his arms in the air wearing his baggy undies. You never see a woman standing there because, of course, women in their underwear, well, that's a little provocative image, but also women's underwear tends to be skimpier. So I think women have some very valid concerns about what would happen to their images on a full body scanner, particularly this week when it turned out that U.S. Marshals in an Orlando, Florida federal courthouse managed to mistakenly leak about 35,000 images from their courthouse scanner to a website. And those images were all posted on Gizmodo.com. Turns out Gizmodo got a hold of them through a Freedom of Information Act request. The U.S. Marshals released all the images from the scanner, and it was as they were decommissioning the scanner, they released the images, and then they sent the scanner back to the manufacturer with all those 35,000 images still on it. So even though the Transportation Safety Administration has tried to assure us that our images will not be saved on the scanner, we know that that is a joke. They have to save the images for a certain amount of time, or else they won't have them for evidence in case of a terrorist attack. They have to save them for at least as long as your flight lasts. And in that interval, even if they do have a program that automatically erases images after a time, I don't believe that's probably the case, at least not for most of the scanners. But even if they do have a program that automatically erases them after an interval of time, there's still the interim. In the interim, a hacker can get in, or an employee can get into the system and download or copy or leak the images. And there's just always the possibility. Anyone who's worked with computers knows that occasionally programs don't run when they're set to run.
Yeah, and it's not like, you know, the internet has any kind of capacity for images to, you know, go viral or anything like that.
Right, exactly.
Yeah.
So I would be deeply concerned about what would happen to my image if I went through one of those scanners.
Yes, of course, we do the show naked, but, you know, that's radio, so we can get away with that.
We do.
Yeah, Jav and Maria are actually in separate rooms as we do this. So.
Okay.
Let's
I'm in my GM.
Let's move on. We'll be talking to you later about that job. A couple policy changes implemented this week. Let's talk about the START treaty.
Yeah.
Snap out of it, John.
Thank you. I'm about to pull over Marie and just start giggling uncontrollably. Yeah, the START treaty looks like it's dead. The Senate this week, the Democrats needed a two-thirds majority, which would require the votes of several Republicans in order for the treaty of nuclear weapons arms reduction with the Russians to take place. And in order to get the Republican votes that they needed, the Democrats had been negotiating with the Republicans' point person on this, Senator John Kyle of Arizona. Kyle had been pushing hard for funding for a new generation of development of nuclear weapons as the price for his and other Republican support. And that had appeared to have been lined up. That was going to be the deal. We're going to reduce arms as long as we build a new generation of them, which is a little head-scratching to begin with, but it's certainly better than no deal at all with the Russians. Well, that deal fell apart this week. A victim of the party of no strategy, Kyle reversed himself and said no. Well, he didn't actually say this, but basically what he was saying was, and what the Republicans were saying was, we can't give the President Obama any policy victory whatsoever, no matter how necessary it is, no matter how bipartisan it is. We saw that also this week with the Fair Wages Equality Act, which would have enabled women to have the same wages for the same work as men. That fell apart too, even though it had bipartisan support. This really has pointed up how completely a minority party can hold a majority party hostage. We've seen this a lot over the last couple of years, of course, and it's just going to get worse with the new Congress in January.
All right. Moving on, California's solution to climate change.
Yeah. Since the federal government seems to be incapable of doing anything on climate change, California continuing to take matters into its own hands, and Arnold Schwarzenegger, the Republican outgoing governor of California, making a surprise announcement this week. And it was interesting that he waited to make it until after he knew that he was going to be followed in office by the Democrat Jerry Brown rather than the Republican Mick Whitman, because Whitman probably would have undone this deal. But Schwarzenegger announcing that California is entering into greenhouse gas emissions deals with developing countries under the partnership of the United Nations, essentially making separate treaty agreements with developing countries, which is something the United States could be doing but is not doing. California, of course, with a larger economy than many of these developing countries, even on its own, not taking into account the rest of the United States. So it's a fairly significant development in terms of the desire to reduce greenhouse gas emissions around the world. And it really, once again, points up the complete lack of political will at the national level to do anything about the urgent crisis.
All right. Well, that then takes us on to international and this week's economic news.
Yeah, I've been hearing about what could be very interesting topic, a microcredit industry collapse. For folks who don't know what microcredit is, about 40 years ago, a man named Mohammed Yunus started what he called the Grameen Bank to make tiny loans to the very, very poor in Bangladesh. Microcredit loans can be as little as $20. They can be a little bit higher than that, $100 or $200. Often they're made to women who have families who need a little bit of money to buy livestock or to buy supplies in order to start a small business or to start a small farm to feed their and support their families. Subprime lending was initially done by small nonprofit groups and nonprofit banks. But in the last 10 years or so, just the same
not subprime, microfinancing.
Or microfinancing, yeah. In the last 10 years or so, though, it's gone the same route as subprime lending here in the U.S. A lot of the banks that used to lend to folks to make mortgages here in the U.S., a lot of those were community banks, or they were credit unions. They were small, and some of them were nonprofit. Well, the microcredit industry has gone the same route. It has gone from being small nonprofit banks to being larger, more consolidated for-profit banks. Many of the banks that now do microfinance lending have stock that trades on public exchanges. For one of the examples of those is the bank that was started or supported by George Soros. I believe it's called SKS Microfinance, an enormous bank now, and probably the largest bank that makes loans in India. Well, I've been hearing things about, I've been hearing some bad things about microfinance lending, a lot of critics of that approach to helping people climb out of poverty say that microfinance loans often come with extremely high and onerous interest rates. In some parts of the world, they can get as high as 60%. For example, in Haiti right now, a lot of the microfinance banks charge between 30 and 55% for a loan. And part of the reason that the interest rates are so high is not just because these are for-profit banks that want to make a profit now, but because they have done exactly what banks here in the United States have done over the last 10 years. They've instituted very lax credit standards. In other words, they make loans without regard to whether the people can actually make the payments on the loans or eventually pay the loans back. And when you have a high default rate like that, you have to jack your interest rates up to break even, not only, and when you put on top of it a for-profit motive, you don't only just have to break even anymore, you have to make a profit for your shareholders.
And very similar to the payday loan industry in the United States, you've also got the phenomenon of people needing to pay those interest rates and then turning around and covering that by making additional loans with different lenders.
Right, and those different lenders don't always ask, do you have loans with another bank? So you have people who initially go in for a $20 microcredit loan and eventually can end up owing $200 or $2,000, and there's no way they will ever in their lifetime, they or their children, be able to pay off that total amount of loans that they have. Now, there's a risk right now of a microcredit loan implosion or collapse. In India right now, big banks have gotten into the game and now have about $4 billion total tied up in microcredit loans. In the state of Andhra Pradesh, which accounts for about one half of the total of all of these microcredit loans, they figure about $2 billion of them have been loaned out in Andhra Pradesh. In total, only about 10% of people have been able to make payments on their microcredit loans as of November 1st. That's a 90% rate of people who may default on their loans. That's an incredible rate. I mean, the standard for banks is about 2 to 3%. Here in the U.S., we've been struggling with defaults that are edging up towards 10%. But if you have a collapse like that in the microcredit finance industry, it could send another shockwave through the world economy. In addition to making it much, much harder for poor people to survive this economic downturn.
All right. Moving on from that to developments in Haiti.
Yeah, speaking of Haiti, the cholera epidemic there continuing to spread this week, now upwards of 1,100 people dead, and a lot of controversy and, in fact, some riots against the United Nations because there's increasing evidence that the source of the cholera epidemic, cholera being a disease that had never appeared in Haiti before last month, was a Nepalese peacekeeping UN mission that was camped in interior in the watershed of an interior river. That interior river, where rather than any kind of a port city or airport, was where the initial cholera cases were located. And now the problem, of course, is that the United Nations initially poo-pooed these reports and refused to investigate the source of the possible source of the cholera epidemic. And so you've had anti-United Nations riots going across much of the north of the country. And Doctors Without Borders also saying that despite with the huge presence of international organizations in Haiti, the cholera response, and this is a direct quote, has to date been inadequate in meeting the needs of the population.
Yeah, and actually the evidence for the source of the outbreak is stronger than that. They did DNA testing on the cholera strain and found that the DNA matched the DNA of a cholera strain that's native to Nepal. So they
Well, and not only that, but there had been an outbreak in Nepal just before the latest deployment of Nepalese UN peacekeepers, and there have been a lot of reports of the base camp that those peacekeepers were using dumping raw sewage into that river,
and
cholera being spread by untreated sewage.
Yeah, and Haiti has had no cholera outbreaks for at least a century, so there's very, very strong evidence that that's the source, and the fact that the UN and the World Health Organization won't do anything to investigate and try to even clean it up, that has sparked these enormous riots in Haiti.
Yeah.
In addition, the UN has a history of occupying Haiti, having troops there for long periods of time. The current deployment has been since 2004, but off and on, it's been decades since Haiti has been completely free of some kind of international or other nations occupying force on its shores.
Yeah, and so what this boils down to in the political sense is with a large popular distrust of the United Nations that's spreading not only to the peacekeeping missions but also to the humanitarian missions, it makes it much, much harder for the UN and UN forces to give humanitarian aid in Haiti. And so what you're winding up with is the constituent nations in the United Nations having to commit to more bilateral agreements to pour money into Haiti to help with the relief for this past year's earthquake. And as we talked about last week, that aid simply has not been forthcoming, particularly from the United States, as different donor countries struggle with their own economic problems. So Haiti once again getting the short end of the stick internationally, and what's old is new again.
Cholera as well.
Yeah, and a dose of cholera as well.
Yeah.
All right. And
by the way, talking about that, they're talking about eventually, because there's no native resistance to cholera, that epidemic could infect hundreds of thousands of people.
Mm-hmm. It's already infected tens of thousands.
Yes.
All right. And finally, NATO.
Yeah, surprise, surprise. NATO has agreed to, we can't say that. Let's just say that America is putting on its latex gloves. But NATO agreeing to create a European defense missile shield yesterday at its meetings in Lisbon. And oh, by the way, at its latest meetings of ministers in Lisbon, enormous anti-Afghan war demonstrations in the streets that the U.S. media has not been reporting at all. But the Military Contractor Welfare Act of 2010 will create a brand new missile defense shield across Europe against actually nobody's quite sure what the threat might be. But
who's the enemy again?
I think it's the Soviet Union. But the successor to the Soviet Union, namely Russia, isn't too happy about this. Press reports in the United States saying, oh, well, Russia will cooperate with this. But if you look at the European press, they're not nearly so sanguine about the prospects of Europe taking this lying Russia, right. Rather, taking this lying down.
I thought Russia was part of Europe.
Yeah. It's part of the Soviet Union. That's the reason why we have to defend ourselves against the Soviet menace. You're 1980. You go. What did you say? When did the wall come down?
How quickly we forget.
Yeah, in any event, I understand the Military Contractor Welfare Act of 2010 will not be the name of the enabling legislation, because that's already been taken six or seven different times this year.
Version 27.
Yes.
All right. Events.
Yeah. One event to speak of coming up in the holiday week where not a lot of speakers or anything like that in town, but Friday will be Buy Nothing Day, the annual day in which people are encouraged not to purchase consumer goods. Of course, the day after Thanksgiving being the traditional shopping day. That seems to have been moved forward several weeks this year, but Buy Nothing Day is an excellent springboard to Buy Nothing Week, Buy Nothing Month, and Buy Nothing Year.
This is the I refuse week. First there's opt-out day, and then 2 days later it's buy nothing.
Yeah, so keep your clothes on and buy nothing this week.
All right. Talking as we do every week, the Job Parish, and we're at Tom Chick, both with Eat the State. And where do people find Eat the State?
www.eatthestate.org is where you find Eat the State and find analysis of international, national, and local news and events and opinion and humor, of course, because we always try and, sometimes all you can do is laugh at this stuff. So www.eatthestate.org, check it out.
And contact email.
info@eatthestate.org. If you have any questions, comments, tips, anything like that, please feel free to get in touch with us.